Here we are, part two of the ego tunnel. So here's another sort of expression of what the ego tunnel means. So I'll just read it out. Our brains generate a world simulation so perfect that we do not recognize it as an image in our minds. And this is essentially, you know, one of the key things that Metzinger's saying that puzzles him in a way. Why don't we recognize it as the image that it is? It puzzles him. And he spends a fair bit of the, I think in the second chapter, trying to explain why don't we experience it? Why can't we kind of step back and see, oh, it's just an image? In an immediate sense. He's able to step back and say, oh, it's an image, in his sort of scientific thinking. But we don't actually ever experience it like that. You know, and for those of you who read Heidegger's picture thing, this might ring a few bells, because Metzinger is saying just what Heidegger was accusing people of saying in the 1930s and earlier, people are trying to understand perception as if we're perceiving a picture of reality. And this is Metzinger's position. We are perceiving a picture of reality generated by the brain, and he's kind of puzzles him why we're not aware of it. And it's right, it should puzzle him, I think, if we've got time to talk about it, because we don't. It doesn't seem to us that we're looking at a picture of reality. It seems to us that we are in immediate contact with the things around us. And you know that myself and Heidegger, my other friend here to my left, would say, well, that's how it is. But do you see, if we're going to maintain that, we have to maintain it in front of this evidence. You know, that's the task, if you like. The task of thinking today, to quote Heidegger, is to, in some sense, rather than be assimilated into this worldview of science, we have to assimilate science into our reality. You know, you can't be in a position of just rejecting it, because it's we're dealing with factual information here. Anyway, so here's this picture. We don't recognize it as an image in our minds. Then they, our brains, generate an inner image of ourselves as a whole, which includes not only our body and our psychological states, but also our relationship to the past and the future and to other conscious beings. I've made beings blue, because we haven't really discussed what beings are here in any detail. The internal image of the person as a whole, he's copying Heidegger there, Heidegger loves the hyphenated, is the phenomenal ego. This is not some little man inside the head. Again, he's in a certain sense, he's trying to criticize an illusion that we have, as far as he sees it, that we really see the world as it is, and that we are like a little individual homunculus inside our heads, looking out of our eyes. And to a certain extent, I think I would agree that that's an illusionary picture of how the brain works. And as soon as you look at the brain, of course, it can't be like that. The little man inside the head has to be able to see and think and have a brain of his own, right? So who's inside his little head? There's an endless regress there. It can't be a little man inside the head. That's a stupid idea. But he's trying to say, because that's a stupid idea, we have an illusory idea of ourself, and the two don't follow from one another. You can have a different idea of what it is to be a being here that doesn't involve you being a little man inside a head. Yes, he's without being explicit about it, he's refuting a few ideas that are obviously false. And then saying that means I'm right. Again, you've got to watch. These are kind of tricks of the trade. For a philosopher, who I don't like to say it, who's peddling a particular worldview, the way you peddle a particular worldview is a little bit like you peddle a political understanding of things. You quietly shove the evidence that's difficult to handle to one side, and you illuminate an obviously false position. You create straw men and you knock them down, and you say, clearly I'm right. And there's an element of what we would call rhetoric behind this ostensibly scientific approach that he's taking. So not a little man inside the head, it's the content of an inner image, namely the PSM. What does that stand for? The personal self phenomenal self model. Yeah, that's it. I'm not good with acronyms. I immediately forget what they stand for. And it's an acronym world out there now, of course.
Americans, they use it a lot. Is he American?
Well, yeah, he's German. Yeah. No, it's to do with being in a hurry. I don't have time. Don't have time to say the whole thing. PSM. Next. You know, it's... yes. So this is just to answer Nicolette's earlier question. So we're placing the self model within the world model. A centre is created. The centre is what we experience as ourselves, the ego. It is the origin of the first person perspective. I think I should be highlighting we here. If we experience this centre as ourselves, then who are we? Do you see he's throwing the problem backwards again? So someone's experiencing this centre. Who's that? And again, we are not in direct contact with outside reality or with ourselves. So who are we in contact with? But we do have an inner perspective. We can use the word I. We live our conscious lives in the ego tunnel. Now, there's a certain level of the language here where you start to, if you look at it carefully, he says elsewhere explicitly, there's no one in the ego tunnel. Explicitly says that. If that's the message, right? There's no one in the tunnel. And here he explicitly says that we live our conscious lives in the ego tunnel. So there are two things here, right? There's an illusory sense of self, but there's someone who's experiencing the illusion. Now, he just doesn't go into that, but it's clearly significant who it is who's, even in this model, who is it who's experiencing the illusion? And somebody mentioned Sartre earlier. So a basic phenomenological understanding of what it means to be conscious is that at any moment you're experiencing something, whatever it is, whether it's reality, an illusion, a dream, you know, whatever it is you're experiencing. At the same time, to be conscious means that you are conscious of whatever it is you're experiencing. In a pre-reflective, always present way. That's, you know, when we talked about the direct knowledge of consciousness at the very beginning of the course, that what does it mean to be conscious? First of all, you've got to stop thinking. Yes, yeah, you've got to become immediately present to what experience is. And then this is something that you can't really put into language, because language is only known on the basis of one's being conscious. There is, and he tries to say it, there's a subjectivity, there's a first-person point of view, but consciousness, it's something that you can only know. And in knowing what it is to be conscious, you realise, yes, there is this experience, and it is known. There doesn't have to be a self that knows it that is different from it. If there is a self there, in some sense, you could say I'm experiencing as myself. The self appears and is known by this pre-reflective consciousness. I mean, this is more of a Husserlian than a Heideggerian way of putting it. but and Sartre made it explicit, that there is always this presence that, if you like, makes known whatever it is that is known. And it doesn't have, it's not personal in the sense that it's got a history. It presents your history, if you like, you, the self, in there. It presents your history, but it's not the history. It's the sheer consciousness whereby anything is known. And that, he doesn't talk of that, right? That is why there's something incoherent in saying that there is no self. Because if there were no self, there'd be no experience. Yeah, there'd be no one, that he wouldn't be able to talk about this, he wouldn't be able to have any ideas. There is something that lies behind all experience, which you could say is your pure consciousness, which you could say is impersonal, but it's not exactly impersonal, is it? Because I'm conscious of this life, not your life.
Yeah?
Yeah,
yeah. I agree on that. The one thing I always came back to is, presumably, if you want to get around that, you say the only reason that, although it's all being consciousness everywhere, that it's specifically with you is because when it tries to act, it can only act by addressing the memories that it can find when it interacts with this part of the continuum.
Yes.
And they're all in that part of your head.
Yes. But the self, if you like, the sense of the being an independent self emerges as soon as you reflect. Yeah? If you don't reflect, there's just the streaming of what is and the knowing of it. And if you reflect, then the knowing of it then knows reflection. And in the reflection, you can look back and say, ah, there's a self that went through all this. There's a past. There's, born on such and such a date. And that's true too, isn't it? Is it an illusion that you were born, that you were having a conscious experience yesterday? Is it an illusion that your name is such and such? Do you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that's associated with this ongoing experience. So, and to be fair to Metzinger, I don't think he's saying that there's no self in that sense. He's just very unclear about what he does mean. What he does mean, in a sense, is that the whole content of your stream of experience is in some sense an illusion, that it's deceiving you. That's essentially what he's saying. He's not saying that you're not conscious and you don't have a sense of self in that deeper sense. But without making it clear, there's a sense I think you may have found in reading it that you just don't know what he means. What he thinks is an illusion.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, he hasn't even defined what illusion could even possibly stand for.
I know.
There's a school of psychiatry when the patient heals heal themselves. And in that kind of school, the psychiatrist tries to kind of bring to the awareness of the patient the kind of disorder that they have. And once they become aware of it, the kind of disorder kind of, it gets treated.
Yes.
So if that is an illusion, how come that this awareness can, like, treat disorder?
Well, no, but I don't think even Metzinger says that the awareness is an illusion. Because he thinks that science, in some sense, discovers truth. So there has to be some kind of conscious subject that knows truth, even for Metzinger, right? Otherwise, as you say, there can't be illusion. There's only illusion if there's truth, and Metzinger certainly thinks that he's in touch with what's true. But so who is in touch with what's true? Do you know, that's the question for Metzinger. There's obviously some kind of almost a true self, which is maybe just, I think for Metzinger, it is just this entirely neutral, impersonal consciousness that, in a way, science inexplicitly attempts to achieve that viewpoint. They think of it as the third person viewpoint, this absolutely impartial, unaffected consciousness that doesn't have any presuppositions in it and sees things as it is. But they regard that as a kind of an ideal objectivity. And science is always aiming at this ideal objectivity. That's why, remember, subjectivity was eliminated. And we just concentrate on what, on the facts, on what can be demonstrated, on the empirical.
I've read somewhere somebody was saying that Metzinger's viewpoint is a little bit similar to philosophical Buddhism, where they see that our experience is what they call the veil of Maya, which is an illusion.
Yes, yes, yes.
Is that right?
Yes, yes. He's done his meditation. He knows his Buddhist thinking, but I'm not sure that certainly there are philosophers, phenomenologists, who take Buddhism seriously. And take phenomenology seriously, who think that Metzinger's God doesn't know what he's talking about,
right,
in this respect.
Okay.
And to think there's a thing here where he seems to be saying there's no self, and there's all of the non-dualist tradition of meditation that says there's no self, and he's drawing a thing here, and a lot of people are doing this, saying, oh, neuroscience is saying there's no self, non-dualism is saying there's no self, ergo, they're the same thing.
Right.
But there's a thoroughgoing materialism in Metzinger's view that is not in the non-dualism.
Yeah. I think the Buddhist perspective is that in order for anything and everything to exist, it has to be able to perceive everything else that exists. And it's that the things perceive each other, that any existence is even possible. And that without perception, there is nothing behind all of that.
Yes.
And so that's like the opposite.
Yes. But as for the veil of Maya, that goes beyond the remit of our course to discuss.
Okay.
Well, because that's, in a way, that's saying our whole life on Earth is a kind of an illusion.
Mm-hmm.
Yes?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's so, but that's not our remit to look at the deep, whether there's a spiritual dimension behind life and death. You know, we're not looking behind life and death.
Everything flashes in and out of nothingness.
Not yet.
Several thousand times has happened.
Yes. Well, apparently it does.
Mm. Yeah. But that was put in a Buddhist text like 2,000 years ago.
Yes. But as phenomenologists, and this is what essentially we're concerned with here, until we can demonstrate phenomenologically that all of existence is flashing in and out of existence several thousand times a second, we have to stay with what's given. Yes? And what's given, just to remind you again, is this immediate stream of experience, our being here. Remember that's... I just have to, every now and then, because we get so far down the line, you have to remind you, that's the only thing that you're clearly, that you clearly actually know, that is actually present to you. In a way, what it all means, whether there's a real world out there, all of those philosophical questions come after the absolute being of this moment. You have to keep on saying that, right? Because the brain, and especially if you've got a Metzinger brain, it's already left that behind, way behind.
Mm.
Yep, that's just an ego tunnel. It's not real. Come with me. Right, that was just a little reminder.
Buddhists must be the ultimate like fools in a Metzinger sort of narrative. It's like, what? You've been sitting around like trying to still your mind to understand reality. You're using that thing to try and better grasp reality. Like, but that's just a sort of, that's just a rough, it mirrors reality, it's not even close.
Yeah, but he's thinking that the Buddhists in some way or other are able to recognise the illusion of the ego tunnel.
Oh, so one of the capacities of the mind that's an imperfect thing of reality, is to perceive the actual reality beyond.
Yeah, yeah, because we have, because it's yeah. part of the myth of science that we have reason, and our reason is able to. We are able to. This is in, remember that this is part of the myth of science that we were looking at, that it's part of this mathematical rational form of thinking that reason is able to reach to the way things are, not perception, not immediate experience. Reason can do it. So reason can reason its way out and reason, the light of reason, which doesn't necessarily have to be...
Okay, yeah. So they would only have a reasoned idea, but they wouldn't have any real perception.
Well, yeah, but Metzinger's... I mean, I've heard him because another one of my students posted a Metzinger podcast or radio thing, and he's certainly done his hours in meditation. So I don't want to dismiss what he may have seen there, but I'm concerned that it should have produced this.
Yeah.
I got a feeling he may be a little bit split, possibly. That he, you know, it can often happen that you have insights.
Which is fair enough, considering the amount of people that tried to do philosophy over the centuries and not came up with a perfect model.
Yeah.
You know. Like,
but the scientific mind, which I was wishing to portray to you earlier, is a logico-mathematical way of thinking, always thinks in terms of models.
It's
mode of operation. I'm just going to take you back. Its mode of operation is always to abstract from the immediate experience, to seek the principles upon which the immediate experience can be founded, and then to reason from those principles an explanation that will explain how our entire world is generated. Do you see that Metzinger is doing just that in relation to consciousness? He's thinking mathematically. It's a logico-mathematical form of thinking, and because it's an abstraction from immediate experience, it can only think in terms of models. Models are idealizations of what we're given in actuality in our experience. So what, if you think in those terms and you think that you're discovering reality that way, reality for you is only ever accessible as a kind of model. And what he's saying here is that the model that you actually experience, which is this ephemeral, coloured, you know, unreal, sensory, phenomenological, that's an inferior, an incorrect model of reality. The true model of reality is the model that the scientific rational thinking has arrived at. So you've got to drop that model and adopt the better model. Yeah? That's what Western civilization has been doing for 400 years, right? Going to drop all that folk psychology nonsense, all that belief in, you know, healing herbs and gods in the sky and all that nonsense. You know, slowly the logico-rational mathematical model of the world is taking us over, right? It's explaining more and more and more, and it wants to be absolute. It wants to have absolute dominion. And I feel again, mater, mother, matter. Yes.
You know, yes. I really like this attitude and this approach, because you're not arguing against it. You're just whatever he wants to do.
So he's just shocked that about the transparency. You know, why can't we see it's a model?
I didn't understand this at all, this transparency business.
Well, the thing about, he recognises that in fact that he's saying it's an illusion, and he's saying to himself, you can always see Metzinger saying, but why can't I see it's an illusion? You know, every time I wake up in the morning, it just seems like it's real. Why isn't it an illusion? Why can't I see the illusion? Why can't I see, I mean, he literally talks about it later. Why aren't I able to see the walls of the tunnel? You know, why can't I see that it's like a picture? Basically, it's like a movie. But if I'm at a movie, I can kind of pull back and say, oh yes, there's the screen, and here am I sitting in the movie theatre. You know, and he's fascinated by the fact that, but with this movie, I don't seem to be able to sit back, you know, and have a kind of a meta experience where I see it's an illusion. I can with my rubber hand experiment, and I can make little illusions happen on the side, but I can't kind of demonstrate in one big kabam that it's all an illusion. So he starts to, it becomes a problem for him to try and explain the transparency. And if I hope to get to it because it's such a ridiculous explanation. In fact, shall I jump ahead?
No, what's the transparency? I still don't want to.
The transparency is you don't see that your experience is an experience of living in a tunnel.
It's got no, substance to you.
Yeah.
It's transparent because it's got no substance.
Yeah.
The ego tunnel's got no substance. You don't get the sense that you're in the ego tunnel.
No, I don't get that sense at all.
No, and he's just... he's describing, he's saying, that's right,
that's
and I'm calling that fact that you can't get any kind of experiential sense that you're in a tunnel, the fact that the tunnel's transparent. The walls, the fact it's a tunnel is transparent to you. You don't see the tunnel, you see what's projected on it, and you take that to be real.
Is that like Plato's cave?
Well, you should have done your reading properly, and you would have. He brings up Plato's cave and says,
yes,
it's exactly like Plato's cave. This is the terrible thing about Plato's cave. Nearly every philosopher appropriates Plato's cave and says, what he meant was what I meant. I don't think so. But in a way, there's something Platonic in this mathematical, logico view of things that says the reality is, I mean, for Plato, it was the reality of the eternal ideas. But for Metzinger, it's the reality of quantum mechanics and electromagnetic radiation. You know, that's what's outside the cave for him. I'm tempted to say we ain't in a cave, but, you know, that it depends. It's a matter of meaning as well. You know, it's a metaphor, isn't it? Why would I say we're not in a cave? Well, I want to say something like, I'm like with Heidegger here. I mean, Maria, are you there or not? Do you know, text... Is it really you sitting there, or is it an illusion? You know, of course you're sitting there, right? We don't really doubt it, do we? Do we? I mean, only when we've done 12 years of philosophy does anything like...
Is he reversing Plato? He's creating a dualism, isn't he, old Metzinger? Is it a reversal of Descartes? Because Descartes started with, you know, well, what can be absolutely certain of is that I'm having these thoughts, whereas Metzinger is reversing it, and he's saying, that's the illusion, and this is real.
Yes, yes. But if you remember the story, I mean, what happened really was that the res cogitans, the consciousness, the substance of consciousness that Descartes proposed, died. So the what was left was the res extensa, which Descartes thought was real as well. He didn't. Descartes thought both were real, and that our experience was an accurate reflection of how things are, all guaranteed by God in heaven. Yeah, but the progress of science caused the idea that there's some separate substance, some spook. This is how it's referred to. That can't be. It can't be that influences the physical. There's only the physical. So that everything that was invested in the reality of consciousness just went away. But the reality of matter now has to, in some sense, be able to generate consciousness from within itself. You see, it's been given a kind of an impossible task. And I mean, I've got to acknowledge that Metzinger and his friends are now coming to a panpsychic kind of understanding. They are starting to change their conception of materialism to say, well, there must be a bit more to matter than we think in order for consciousness to come out of matter. Mm-hmm. Consciousness, in some sense, must have been present in potentia, in matter, all along. So the kind of crude materialism of the past is being changed by consciousness science itself. So things aren't fixed, but it don't change the crux of the message. The crux of the message is that your living life and your sense of self is an illusion. And that it doesn't change the mathematico-logico model-based understanding that the ultimate reality is in the objectivity of science. But the ontology is starting to shift a bit because materialism is so obviously false.
You must think that, though, John. You must think that. I mean, I can't believe they don't think that. I mean, the people on the bus, the people we all work with or deal with, the whole... Nobody's thinking like this. I mean, they must... See that, your man in the street, the people that do the bits.
No, it's that scene. That's
99% of the population on the globe is not thinking like this.
But if you grasp the atmosphere in the background, that's fully understood because you're all in a dream out of which we scientists have awoken and are beginning to awake more and more. And have been for years, and the people on the bus, their understanding of science is around about coincident with about 1890. Yeah, your average citizen is about around 1890. Well, that's not unreasonable, right? You're 100 or so years behind. Isn't long, is it? Yeah. So the thinking being that, you know, in another 100 of years, you may have caught up maybe with Einstein.
But he wrote this for the public, didn't he?
No, yeah. he wrote this for the educated public, which is that small minority of people who are interested in philosophy of mind and what neuroscience means. And there are that small minority is many hundreds of thousands of people across the earth, but it's not the people on the bus. It's not the people who voted for Brexit by and large, although that's not to say that, you know, I don't wish to.
What about the Eagleman programme?
The Eagleman programme was a nice story that expressed this with pictures and didn't really drive home the ontological consequences of what it all meant.
It presented it to the public.
Yeah. And the public, I think people, you see, my sense is, watch programmes like that and get into a documentary frame of mind and accept it all and then go back to their ordinary lives and forget it all. you've got little compartmentalised understandings. You know, you see a programme like that and it presents a certain view, you say, oh, that's fascinating, that... the whole brain is just kind of an illusion. I'm hallucinating my experience. Yeah, that's interesting. Maybe I am. Yeah, dinner. What's for dinner? You know. You know. Yes, that's right. What did you say? You know. Is that? There's no illusion then, is there? When you stamp on my foot. You know. That's the old argument, isn't it? It's an illusion for as long as you're in that frame of mind. And I suspect it is for Metzinger as well. You know, nobody can keep that up, you know, when you're having a divorce.
So is it a type of episode that he's doing then?
I called it such, actually. I call it the objective epoche. As long as you're being a scientist, you put an epoche over your entire subjectivity and you just think in terms of the objectivity of what shows up when you when you only deal with the measurable.
He's just doing his job.
Yeah. Yeah, he's doing his job. But in that epoche for him is not one state and the other state is on the same level. His epoche, his scientific epoche, stands above all for him in his life. Like Husserl's epoche stands above the natural attitude. Yes, the epoche is the greater reality, even though we may not sustain it. And he would have an explanation just like Husserl, because when you come out of the epoche, you become identified with the ego tunnel. That's part of the... If you don't separate from it, you're identified with it. And that's... You see how that makes sense, can't you?
Mm.
So there's no one in the tunnel. And he says that, and it's absolutely fascinating here. You... Right, there's no one in the tunnel. The physical person as a whole. So he's defined you, right? Because I was hoping that he was going to say something intelligent sometime and say, the actual presence of consciousness, see through the tunnel. But actually then he says something shocking. You, the physical person. Now, what's that? Does he mean the body as a whole, all of the molecules of the body are seeing through it? What does he mean? That's where, at a certain level, he becomes incoherent. You know, I've been cutting him some slack here, but I bolded that up because, what? That's the first time he mentions it, as far as I can see. And he's just using it colloquially. You, the physical person. What do you mean? I mean you there. Yeah, but who's that? That obviously doesn't see, does it? What? Who's doing the seeing? Thomas? I'd like you to say. He probably would if he was here. In fact, if he was here, we'd be having an entirely different conversation. And I'd be a lot more restrained. Just say, in case you're listening, Thomas, you know, this gets out. But that's the beauty, you know, having your own class, your own. You wait to hear. If only I was important enough for him to give a class on me. You'd see somebody entirely different. Because I suspect that Metzinger, as the man, if he were here, he would be someone entirely different. But all we have to go on is a statement like that. You do not see it, but you see with it. Me, the physical person, sees with it. Do you see there's a certain way where I just can't put that sentence together and see what he could possibly mean. You know, it's verging on a sentence that has no meaning for me.
There's no meaning he's getting up with.
No.
Right, the physical person as a whole, which can see things, which isn't the neurons in the brain.
It's not the neurons in the brain, and it's not the illusion.
He's not defined that at all.
No.
He's a scientist. He should define his
text. Well, he did write another book called Being No One. That's his kind of formal scientific account of the ego tunnel. And maybe if we looked in there,
maybe
we'd find he did a bit of a more thorough job. But even so, I think he owes us a bit more than he's giving us here.
Yeah, we've only got.
Because no one lives in the ego tunnel. But someone sees through it. And that's what the distinction he's making. You see through it, and when you see through it, it seems like you're in it. But you're not in it, you're outside it, seeing through it. Who are you seeing through it? The physical body. Well, we have to wipe that. That makes no sense. The only way you can make sense of this is the you that's seeing through it is the pure consciousness. That would make sense. I could follow it then if he was saying that. And again, there's no little man running things inside our head. That's who he... That's his kind of... I don't think anyone really thinks that anymore, either. It's you know, when it's a... Yes?
Have you got a key for the filing cabinet?
I locked it back in the...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Do you need to put anything back after?
Yes. Yeah.
Just make sure it's locked after, then?
Yes. Are you going to put the key back? I didn't know who was coming to...
The key, it was just open.
I put the key back... But I didn't lock it.
I don't know. But
that's naughty.
I said you can just lock it when you go, that's all.
But where's the key going to be?
I think it's probably still in the...
Wait, when you finish with it, I mean.
Well, I haven't used it, but I
found
it.
Oh, in fact, you're going to do nothing.
Yeah, is that all right?
Do nothing and I'll take care of it.
Yeah.
So, yes. So there's the magic word that's used more and more that ties into what Heidegger says, that what we see in the ego tunnel is a representation, a kind of a picture. So it's an attempt to represent what's out there. So we're getting to is this a more of a philosophical description of what he thinks perception is. Perception for him is a seeing of a representation of what's out there on the wall of the ego tunnel. That's his model.
We can come up with a structure of reality, but we don't see reality.
Yes. Yes, but the sense is, and this is what representationalism means, is that there are things out there that have a certain form, and we represent them internally. Like we make a copy of them, in some sense. And in a way, something like that is going on in the brain. If you were to trace it, you would say, oh yeah, I'm looking at this computer, and somewhere the form of the computer... that we see, we will find in the brain some kind of analogy to the, you know, you could describe it mathematically, the relations that make up the shape of that computer. You would find the same set of relations occurring in the brain. Bertrand Russell described that very well with the process of recording a sound with a microphone. And then storing that information that the microphone has picked up as electrical vibrations onto an album. You know, it was vinyl in his day, as the indentations in the vinyl. And then the indentations in the vinyl, you put it on a record player and you put the needle on the record player. The needle vibrates, picks up the indentations, transverts that back into electrical signals that then go to a speaker. And the speaker then causes the vibrations in the air, and the vibrations in the air come into your ear. And then your ear picks up that with hairs, and then the hairs in your ears go through to the neurons, and the neurons pick up the vibrations in the ear, turn that into signals. From the sound through the recording to coming to your ear to getting in the brain, the same form has been present all the way through.
Mm-hmm.
Yes? In all of those different media, the same form has been there.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way that when we say representation, you'd say, yeah, the form of the computer, you will find that somewhere in the behaviour of the neurons in your ego tunnel. His understanding is the behaviour of those neurons are representing the out there computer. I feel I have to say one thing here, that if there were no brain... doing that, then there would be no distinction between the computer and anything else. I just want to remind us of that, because this is part of what I want to say about the brain. The fact that the computer has got edges round it that has, if you like, pulled it out from the entire rest of the universe, has occurred because of our brain. Yeah, it wasn't like that until a brain pulled it out. David Bohm, who's a physicist, describes this as unfolding. You've unfolded the computer as an object in a three-dimensional space out of something that we don't know. What it is, we don't know that it what dimensionality it has. There was no distinction between the computer and the if there is anything out there, like the electromagnetic radiation he mentions, there's nothing that says computer here, rest of the world there.
Yeah.
So that there isn't a you want to say, right, yes, there is a computer out there, but you have to see no brain, no distinction, no computer. So I just want to put one problem in front of representation, that you're not representing an object that's out there. The brain in itself, in unfolding the computer, is making there at least 50%, if you like, is creating the distinction that is the computer. So you can't really say that the brain... I'm digressing off here. This isn't Metzinger. You can't really say that the brain is representing the computer. The brain is presenting the computer. And language is so important here. And this is why I crawl when I see the word represent. Because it's got in it a little model as if what you're experiencing in the ego tunnel, granting him that, is a kind of a copy of a world out there full of all of the same objects, all laid out in just the way that we represent them. But do you see, we create a world. And another thing I'd like you to get your mind around is, because I'm Metzinger's here, and he's saying, yeah, I'm with you there. It's a kind of an illusion. What's really out there, I agree, I'm with you, John. There's all that electromagnetic radiation is out there. Now, what you've got to grasp is the idea that there's all that electromagnetic radiation out there is just another idea. It's just another way of unfolding a kind of a mental understanding of what is. There isn't electromagnetic radiation out there either. That's just another model that we, through our science, currently have of what's out there. And in fact, that really is a representation. Yes, the idea that it's all electromagnetic radiation is entirely a representation based on an abstraction out of our immediate experience through using measuring instruments to kind of portray a little image of what's out there. So that, yes, that there's really, what's really there is electromagnetic radiation, and that's what he says in a minute, or he may already have said that. Now that's a representation. But our experience, this immediate experience of the table, the chair, the cup, is a presentation. This is a fine distinction. If you get the fine distinction, everything that Metzinger's saying collapses. Because it's on... He thinks that his scientific model is more real than our presentation of there being a world. We were talking about an inversion somewhere, right? He's inverted. There's the model. There's the experience from which we abstracted the model, and then there's the inversion. The model's what's real. The immediate experience out of which we abstracted the model is illusion. Or it's an incorrect model. But from that perspective, everything's a model. So our experience is a model. It's really just the neurons firing in the brain. But it ain't. Our experience is not, palpably not, neurons firing in the brain in the way that we experience it now. And not only that, there's nothing about the firing of neurons in the brain that in any way resembles the colours, the sounds, the qualities of our being here. Is that? There's another nice silence there. Yeah.
I don't know about neuroscience.
Well, it's not about if we had perfect knowledge of neuroscience and we knew exactly the kinds of pattern that of neural activity that needs to be there in order to experience the smell of a rose, right? That's what he talks about, right? There's nothing about the firing of those neurons that smells like a rose. Now, and Metzinger's aware of that, and he's saying the smell of the rose is a kind of an illusion, and the reality is the firing of the neurons. And I'm saying, well, no, the smell of the rose is not an illusion. It is what it is. It's, there's just no way it's an illusion. Is it? Smell. There's no rose here, right? Maybe it's a bad example, but when you smell a rose, right, the quality of the scent of the rose is the quality of the scent of the rose. A rose is a rose is a rose by any other name, right? The form of the rose, the colour and the shape of the rose is the form and the colour and the shape of the rose. Now, the firing of the neurons, you would be able to map something of the form of the rose onto the firing of the neurons, but you see the firing of the neurons is occurring in an entirely different dimension to your experience of the beauty of the rose with all its petals, the coolness, the way that they feel, the scent of the rose. The dimensionality in which that's occurring is entirely discontinuous with the get the scalpel, open up the brain, and watch and have a look. Yeah, and I point to you and I say, there, you see, there's the rose. You know, and we could do it. We have a mirror, right? You're having the brain surgery. You're looking at the rose, and you're in the mirror, there's the surgeon with the knife saying, there, there's the rose. Do you see what I mean? It's not however much neuroscience you know, there's no the absolute distinction between your experience of the rose and what's going on in your brain is just a child can see it.
But what I experience of the rose, I experience because of the nature of my sense organs. If I was another animal, I'd...
Yes. No, we're not denying. We're not saying they're not connected.
No.
We're not saying that then the surgeon's knife inadvertently slips, end of rose for you. Right? There's definitely a connection there.
Okay.
But do you see, the question is, well, what kind of connection? Do you see that it's just a deeply extraordinary, almost inexplicable miracle that those two things are present to us, and if you read Metzinger, you'll in a certain sense you'll see that he doesn't actually see that, because seeing that is a matter of a kind of an immediate intuition. And not an intuition like, oh, you know, I just had an intuition that Chelsea are going to win the cup. It's an intuition that's an immediate knowledge of that's the way it is. Something that analytic philosophy is unable to recognise. Do you see? Because any kind of thing that you say, I just know it because it's immediately present to me, is not evidence in the third person world. That's how come people can actually say absurdities like consciousness is an illusion. I mean, Metzinger's not saying anything as simplistic as that. He's saying that not that the ego tunnel does present us with a world, but what he's saying is the illusion is the meaning we attribute to our experience. The illusion is we attribute our experience to being an actual experience of the world, not an experience that's going on in our brain. And again, you see, you come back to that and you say, well, he's right. It is an experience going on in our brain. To which I say, think again. And I feel that, you know, that I want to explain a little bit further why it isn't an illusion. Even though I'm only on slide 8. Because we should be up to this. I mean, I hope I should be up to it anyway. Then you've got to be up to it to follow me. The thing that Metzinger doesn't understand here is intentionality. So it's true in a certain way that when I'm looking at this cup, I'm seeing a certain face that it's showing me, just a partial face that it's showing me, insofar as it impinges onto my retina, and insofar as the signals get down my optic nerve through the lateral geniculate nucleus to my visual cortex. You know, all of that, I'm not denying all that whole story, right? And all that I'm aware of in looking at that cup is based on the information that's coming through that channel, if you like, and through my own brain's pouring down on that with all of its predictions and knowledges of cups beforehand. But my intentionality understands and means that it says what that means, that visual impression that I'm having, is that there's a cup there. That's what that means. And my intentionality experiences the being a cup there. Now, this is just so terribly simple. Even though the whole story about what's going on in my brain is true, and if I'm only seeing one side and one face of it, and that's all to do with the neurons going on inside my head, my intentionality, which understands that visual experience to mean that there is a cup there, is true. There is a cup there. Do you see it? He's mixing up. He's just because we actually, what we experience is a visual image, he's thinking that we're experiencing an illusion. But we're experiencing a visual image of there being a cup there, and there is a cup there. Do you see? It's just a small thing, but it's absolutely crucial. Of course, I only ever see, you know, I look at Nicolette, and I just see what the photons are bouncing off. That's right. Yes, it's just an image of her. I can't see her. I know that, right? I don't think in a way that. But the image that I get from the photons bouncing off Nicolette that get into my brain, that become a certain pattern in my brain, becomes for me, I understand what that means. I experience what that means. What that means is Nicolette is sitting over there.
Yeah.
That's what it means.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
The brain attributes.
Yeah,
I'm
not. Yeah, by my intentionality, which can in no way be explained in terms of neurons firing, understands what the activity in the brain means, and what you experience. You don't experience the neurons firing; you experience the meaning.
Well, you attribute the meaning.
Yeah, well, when you say, when I say I attribute the meaning, you know, there's some intelligence here, which you could say I am, that knows what it all means. And to a certain extent, you could say that intelligence is already outside the brain. You see, if the intelligence were only in the brain, and only knew what was going on in the brain, it would be like Metzinger says. You'd just be having an experience of neurons firing. But our intelligence understands that when our neurons are firing in that way, that means that Nicolette is over there. That means there's a cup there. You see, the consciousness, or if you like, the intelligence, is already outside of the outside of the skull.
The intelligence is trying to discern meaning all the time.
Yeah.
It gets fooled, it gets tricked.
Yeah.
But the intelligence is actually like discerning is discerning meaning. It's not copying fake.
It's not looking at a wall of an ego tunnel in the brain.
No.
It's like reading a text and saying, what does this text mean?
Exactly. It's doing its best job to interpret meaning from. Occasionally it gets tricked by a stick and it thinks it's a snake.
Yeah.
What have you. And
you're on it. Yeah. You're on it.
But it's actually ruling through all of these possibilities and then attributing meaning.
Yes.
Yeah.
And do you see the act of attributing meaning already understands what it means for there to be a world, what it means that there are other beings here. It already understands the being of another being, it already understands the being of a cup, it already understands the being of space, and it already understands time. It encompasses all of that, and all of that, you can't. None of that can be. You see, the neurons firing have no meaning, and we don't experience the neurons firing. This is Metzinger's error. He thinks we're experiencing the neurons firing. We're not. We're experiencing the meaning.
Yeah, we're discerning discerning meaning from the fake perceptions we get and the good perceptions.
Yeah. And we're seeing it.
We're constantly sifting.
Yeah.
From our mirrored image of the.
They are against this.
But I would even mirroring is not quite right, because the word I like to use is what happens in our brains through this recurrent prediction of what's going on is we get attuned to certain forms that are around us,
mm-hmm.
and what the brain does in its projections is it's trying to attune to the incoming signals,
mm-hmm.
and when it tunes in, it's like a TV set or a radio station. It tunes in and then says, "Shh, yes, I've got the form," and I'm not. I don't have a static image in here. Every second, when I'm having immediate experience, I'm getting feedback from outside that's attuning me, right? So my little radio station is tuning in to Boris. It's just, do you see? Every second, it's catching your nodding. Your nodding is, I'm attuning to it. Do you see? And my attunement is a true attunement. I truly am attuning to you, and I experience that. You nod, you intend to nod. I see you nod. I'm not experiencing an illusion.
Yeah.
Why would I even think that?
Yeah.
It's so, it's mad, isn't it? Do you see that it's so mad? This view, this materialistic scientific view of the brain and the ego tunnel, so runs in the face of what we deeply know in our being to be the case. You're looking at me, Alex, aren't you? I know you're looking at me. You know you're looking at me. You know I'm looking back at you. I'm not looking at an ego tunnel. I'm attuned to you. I mean, at a certain level, you could say, yeah, it's all going on in your brain, but it's, you see, the intentionality that understands the meaning is already ahead of that. It already knows that there's what's going on here. And if it didn't know what was going on here, it would have no idea of there being an inside and an outside and a me and a thou. It would just be an experience of a lot of neurons going.
That's a proposal of what sort of has happened in computer science. They thought it was going to be easy to get, once they could get it sophisticated enough, it would be easy to get computers to do things. And the thing they're running up against is they can't get them to differentiate between all the stimulus.
Well, you know, that's my area. So I have to say that don't underestimate what they're going to be able to do with computers, especially as it becomes clearer and clearer how the brain resonates, because I think we're going to be able to build resonance machines ourselves, and then we get the whole question of, are they going to be conscious? To which I say, I don't think so, because I think, going back to an earlier part of the course, it matters that we're alive, and being alive has to do with a certain form of organisation that we have. based on living cells. But that's a discussion for another day, I think. So I've leapt ahead because it's nearly two. We've still got time to indicate that, you know, intentionality is something that we, if you've done both courses, intention, almost the first course was intentionality. Do you see that this is an account of perception which is without intentionality? And these boys know about intentionality. When you mention it, they say, oh no, we've got it covered. You know that feedback going on in the brain, that's your intentionality. See? But do you see the intentionality is... is pure meaning. The intending is the intending of a pure meaning. If you just say, oh, it's the neurons firing, you haven't accounted for what intentionality is. You haven't accounted for this whole dimension that is able to, in some sense, I don't think it is like this, but in some sense, it's like there is an intelligence that reads the meaning of what's going on in the brain. And that reading of the meaning of what's going on in the brain is your experience. You see, the science gets so far and then misses the entire dimension of what intelligence consciousness is. And why does it do that? Because it forgot about it about 200 years ago with the collapse of the dualistic ontology of Descartes.
Experience is our reading of what goes on in the brain.
Yes. There's an understanding, and I'm not saying, I mean, this is just a metaphor. I'm not saying that there's some disembodied entity that looking at the brain and then producing experience. I'm just saying, do you see if you think that there's something like a physical brain, the entire thing that is able to transform the firing of that neuron into the meaning of experience as we know it is left utterly unrecognized. Okay. It's just not noticed. Do you see, what's not noticed is our very being.
Because if there is a meaning, as you're saying, then who's going to define this?
As long as you're looking for physical neurons doing stuff, there ain't no meaning. There's no, the, you, right. don't, you can't
or, find. Or an electrical wave, or whatever you want to call it. There is only the electrical wave.
Yes.
There is a political repercussions to the idea that there is a meaning. The political repercussions that these guys are against.
Well, I don't think that they even think in those terms. They're going with the status quo, and there is a status quo that says you better not step too far out of line here, and shake the foundations of the culture. Not that. If you do step out of line and you shake the ontological foundations of the culture, it's not as if you're going to be, the KGB are going to get you. It's going to be the self-censorship of scholars. If you step too far out of line, then you stop getting published, you don't get any grants, you don't get promoted, and it's adios.
So it's polarized, culture is polarized.
But it works, it doesn't work by anybody, there's nobody up there saying thou shalt. It's self-regulating, because the rewards and punishments are all set up that way. So there's no one to blame, but the reason that there's no one to blame, if I'm on a roll, is deeply connected with this view of who we are. Because do you see, this view of who we are, this ego tunnel view of who we are, actually has deeply embedded in it the fact that no one is responsible. And I see my own, if I'm going to step outside of that, I see that as deeply embedded in our culture. There's no one responsible. When the corporation basically rapes the planet, we've set up a structure there where no one is responsible. You've got the shareholders. If the corporation don't make a profit, the shareholders disinvest and they invest in somebody who makes a profit. You've got the management ostensibly in charge. The management, if they make decisions that go against the determination of the marketplace, they lose their jobs. You know, all the rewards and punishments are all in place so that nobody can stand up. If anyone stands up and takes a stand and says, I'm a human being, I'm taking responsibility for this, we can't close down this factory, we can't throw all these people out of work, it's just wrong. We can still run the plant, it's just going to make a bit less money. We'll still make profit. That's the end of your career. Yeah, you just get replaced by somebody who's willing to do that. And your gesture meant nothing. And it's just the same in Parliament, essentially. No one's responsible there, are they? Just well, the playing out of Brexit is just a demonstration of that no one's responsible. Because there is no... we've abrogated our responsibility to a scientific technological understanding of how things are. And in that scientific technological understanding of how things are, there is no place for a human being. We got rid of the human being with Galileo. I mean, it's a.
We've
got
no responsibility.
Oh yeah, and that's I don't like to say it because it's almost as if you know you, the next thing is I'm going to be joining Hitler and joining the Nazi Party. But that's that's democracy, right?
But haven't we also got, in parallel to that, an absolutely dreadful blame culture where if you, I don't know, if you fall over, you're immediately suing.
Yeah. But that's no. It's not that there's no responsibility. It's I'm not responsible.
Yeah. There's no self-responsibility.
The world, in some sense or other, is responsible. Now, I still maybe, because of my ego tunnel illusion, blame individuals, but basically it's all being done to me, and that's exactly what the scientific worldview says. Too right, it's all being done to you. You just don't know. You're not blaming the right thing. You should be blaming the laws of physics. It's the laws of physics that's doing it to you. Do you see? The more that we get embroiled in that understanding, that we're determined by the materiality of the world, right? Remember, right? Mater, mother, she determines everything we do. This, in her inconceivability, you know, created this great and marvelous universe, these billions of galaxies. It's entirely her that determines our bodies, our brains, how they behave. She rules all. I'm not responsible. If I think I'm responsible, I'm just paraphrasing Metzinger. If I think I'm responsible, I'm just having a certain kind of illusion. I can't help it. I mean, because it's part of our, you know, it's a part of our genetic inheritance from evolution that animals that think they're responsible survive better.
It's human nature.
Yeah, the reason that we're under this kind of illusion, as he's about to explain later, is that it was entirely determined by evolution. And that's us. We're utterly determined by evolution, by our genetic makeup, by the laws of physics. There isn't any agency. Our idea of agency is an illusion. And do you see that our entire culture, in some sense or other, although it came from a culture of kings, dictators, aristocracy, it's slowly becoming, we're all being leveled down to a state of equal absence of responsibility. And it's not the connections in not obvious, but I think that there is one.
The other footnote on that is, like, I don't think the modern generation has even the slightest clue of the power of integrity. If you figure out even slightly what that means and try and hold something that reflects that throughout your life when it comes to, I would imagine, your ability to do things. Like, an integrity means understanding what your actual principles are and actually living by them. And
yes.
I don't think that's even a modern concept.
No, that's very...
What happened yesterday? All those school children went out on strike.
Well, how old are they?
Some of them very small, by what I could see. They all about the planet.
Are they all giving up their phones? I mean, we'll stop travelling on buses. I mean, what are they actually trying to do?
They were protesting about, I think, the state of the planet, global warming.
Everyone wants the planet to survive. What are they trying to do? I mean, I think it's unfair to get children to solve problems
that
adults
can
barely
manage.
You know,
This is how it works. Political laws, they need a democratic kind of foundation in order for it to be active, to be implemented. And if there is no democratic foundation, they create democratic foundation. This is how it works. And all the laws, policies, they come from...
I've opened this hornet's nest now. I couldn't resist. You know, when I'm saying that what we're talking about in relation to science looks like, well, why are we so worried about science? I was pointing that out, that this view of human agency, of what it is to be human, that's coming out of our scientific culture, is not about to take things over. It's already crept deep into our culture, deep into the absence of our regard for what you're saying, the integrity of each individual human being, even though we're obsessed with our rights.
But in the young children, you're teaching them that the way to solve the problem is not to become particularly capable in any given area. It's to tell the government to do something about it, or to tell someone to do something about it. And the problem I have is everyone's saying that we need to keep on pointing fingers, there's not enough money, whatever, right? And we're very, very slow to recognise how people can be excellent, or good, or even encourage the idea that you have to work hard.
And you said I won't say anything when you came in here. I'd just like to remind you that when you came in, you said, I'll be quiet, I won't say anything. You did say that, didn't you? That doesn't mean you have to be quiet, but I'm going to read you what I wrote this morning just because it was on my mind. It's like we're on the Titanic and we see the iceberg looming. We call to the captain to alter course, but there is no captain on the bridge. Just an automatic pilot, an inscrutable computer program like HAL in 2001. But this ship just mirrors each one of us in our own inability to exercise any true authority over our own selves.
Yeah, cool. There's a reason I turned up talking.
That was just a little bit of a rant from me, because it all of that, right, the whole thing, it all comes back down, because this is a great get out card. Do you know this is an enormous get out card?
Yeah, which anyone and everyone can actually see easily.
It's because there's no one in the tunnel, right? I just rephrase that. There's no one on the bridge of the Titanic, is there? I mean, the iceberg's pretty clear, isn't it? I mean, we're not quite sure how big it is, where it's going to hit the ship, but we see we're heading straight for it, and all we need to do is turn left or right. But we can't turn left or right, can we? You know, that's why I'm about to say, you know, if Hitler had won the war, and please don't quote me on this, I don't think that that's a good idea, right? But you see, because that's not the answer. The answer isn't to have some dictatorial authority. Right, we've rejected that, but what have we replaced it with? With a kind of essential abrogation of authority by everyone. I mean, not everyone. That's a cruel thing to say, right? Because of course there are people who care and there are people who are taking action. But en masse, as the culture that we are, we're going in that direction. And the reason that we're going in that direction is deep. It's deeply embedded in our scientific materialistic view of how things work here. It's not just capitalism and it's not just the evil corporations. Do you know, it's right in the very fabric of our culture.
Yeah. And on that line, to me, the revolution is when the poorest people make their environment more beautiful just because they can, through their own efforts, and just demonstrate a better reality than anyone who's pushing a narrative that doesn't do anything.
Now, look. We've got a few minutes left. I'm just going to spin through here because, in effect, I've sort of. I thought I'd do this. I'd get more interested in what I had to say than Metzinger, because I think essentially, what Metzinger has to say is the same thing over and over about the ego tunnel, and he's suffering from the same form of misunderstanding about what it is to perceive. It's a quite simple. The nature of perception, whether it's an illusion or not. But the consequences of thinking like that are immense, and they come from a deep-seated ontology which says that we are ruled by power beyond us. So scientific knowledge of reality, yes, he's saying, although we live under an illusion, we are capable of developing of getting out of the illusion. How do we get out of the illusion? Well, it's Thomas and his mates. It's the scientific community that and this is the myth of science, right? The myth of science is it's all right because for the first time on Earth we've got rid of all of that nonsense about religion and da 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 da. Our whole history, which is, I agree, a kind of nightmare. You know, it's not as if we can look back to anything with great pride there. He's saying it's okay. Finally, with the scientists were born. Admittedly, we're in a minority, but finally we have our scientific view of things is a correct model. We're able to supersede your poor, benighted, delusional, ego tunnel view of things. And then he talks about the neural correlates of consciousness. I love that. See, because I think he really does live in a world where me and my friends here really have any grasp or grip on reality. Other people, what they call evidence, isn't evidence. So he's quite clear that he's got a. That we can't really contradict what he's saying here because all the evidence points to it. Although, I think in this sense, him saying that what we experience can be localized to events occurring in the brain in terms of unless those events are happening, we don't have experience, is... I think we rely on that to have an experience of being here on the earth. Whether there's some possible experience, you know, we were talking about Maya and that there's life beyond death and all of the rest. I'm saying neutral on that. Because obviously if there's life beyond death and some kind of experience, then you don't require a brain for that. And there is some kind of neurological evidence that people in deep coma go off and experience stuff that where there's no corresponding activity in the brain, to indicate that the experience that you report having when you come back out of the coma could possibly have anything to do with your brain. But, you know, if I'm Metzinger enough to know the answer to that, the answer to that is, no, well, you didn't have any experience when the brain was virtually brain dead. You made it all up when you came back.
Yeah.
And it just seems to you that that happened. To which, and I can feel it, and you can feel the arms crossed and say, well, disprove that, sucker. You know, you can't. You can't. If there were, do you see what, this is the amazing thing about materialistic science. If the only evidence you could possibly have that there was any kind of experience beyond there being brain activity just wouldn't show up as evidence for science. Hence, all the evidence. What he means is all the physical evidence, which for materialistic science is all the evidence. But that's why I did write all the evidence, except, of course, the evidence of your own immediate experience, which doesn't count. Let's not say it doesn't count. It counts insofar as we will listen to what you say you're experiencing and we'll bear that in mind. But it's not evidence in its own right. So yes, at the bottom he says the majority of philosophers and most neuroscientists would say, which means it's the case, that if you activate the right part of the brain, you will get the exact same experience that you're having now in this room, even if you weren't in the room. It's the brain in the vat idea, and this is widely accepted now, that it should be possible to create a full-blown experience of the being in the world just by artificially stimulating the brain. What isn't often mentioned with the brain in the vat is that the stream of information coming into that brain, you know, that enables you to look around, would have to be a complete and accurate simulation of the entire universe. And such a simulation would be, do you see, it's a kind of an impossibility. If you were able to simulate the entire universe, then it, in a certain sense it would be the entire universe. And you, one of the things about the brain in the vat story, you know the picture is that your brain's in a vat and it's connected up to all these cables and things that's connected up to this giant machine that then generates a world, sends the signals down through your sensory nerves, and you just get experience of the world. But what's often neglected there is that then your efferent motor cortex will be sending signals back out again, telling you to move your body, that then has to go back to that computer, and the computer then has to change the sensory inputs to reflect what you just told your body to do. And the computer program that would have to do that, right, would have to enable the world, like in Neo in The Matrix, it would have to be, to be convincing, right, you'd have to be able to get on an aircraft and go to Australia, yes? You'd have to be able to take a rocket and go up to the moon. All of that would have to be within the capacity of that computer program to generate for the brain in the vat. It would be indistinguishable from this universe. And this, Dave Chalmers is somebody who thinks, and maybe that's all that's going on here.
Yeah.
Maybe that's
Elon Musk as well.
Yeah. Maybe that's it. Maybe that is it. We're just kind of a bizarre sort of experiment. The thing is, if we were under such an experience, this computer, again, as I was thinking of it before, it would in some sense be present in that enormous computer program that was generating things. The form of the program would be present, the form of the computer would be present in that machine. And my perceiving the computer, if I were a brain in the vat, would be a true perception of the form of the computer in the machine.
Yeah, I mean, what does it matter what the atoms are?
Yeah, your universe. It doesn't actually change anything.
Your atoms are electronic signals,
yeah,
in the computer, or they're the atoms,
yeah,
of the physical whatever. It's like they're still the atoms of your universe.
The only worrying thing there is the idea that you're the only one here, and everyone else is being fabricated by the machine, and there aren't any other beings. There's just you and the machine, and then that gets a bit, you know. There's not. Then you start to realise, well, why am I bothering to imagine that? Let's just spin. I'm spinning. Consciousness. In a way, I'm just saying, consciousness is the appearance of a world. No. Consciousness is the apprehension of a world. Consciousness is the knowing apprehension of a world. Isn't it? I'm just looking at the English. Consciousness. Would you say consciousness is the appearance of a world? What does that mean again? Do you know it's a
apprehension.
Yeah, it's, if you say apprehension, that means that you, it's a knowing experience. Yeah. It's not an. He wants to try and say consciousness is the appearance of the world, as if the world is an appearance. It's not real. Yes, he's. I think he's just playing with language there. And then he says something even more strange. He says that a single and unified reality becomes present. But I thought it was an illusion, Thomas. Is it a reality or is it an illusion? Do you see, he's just using English in a way that is... I don't think he's being deliberately obfuscating. He's just sort of slipping in between colloquial English and then using terms a bit more precisely. I think that's what he's doing. And again, I love that. All our data indicate that consciousness is a part of the physical universe. To which I'd say, well, no... None of our data indicate that consciousness is a part of the physical universe, because we have no such data that indicates things one way or the other. All that we have is the fact that there's a correlation between what happens in the brain and your conscious experience. That doesn't mean that consciousness is a part of the physical universe. It says nothing about that. And this is where, I mean, you start to feel like you're being almost manipulated when he says something like that. And is an evolving biological phenomenon. No, all that we can say is that according to our empirical study of the past, bodies have evolved. Brains have evolved. Consciousness, in the sense that we would say it's the pure apprehension of meaning, in what way has that evolved? Was consciousness there once and it didn't apprehend meaning? Well, then it wouldn't have been consciousness, would it? You know, consciousness is a kind of a binary thing. It's either there or it ain't. Now, what evolves, if you like, is brains, and then you could say that the kind of appearance, to use his word, that a tick has, or a bee or an ant, is quite different to the appearance that we have. So that evolves, but consciousness, in what sense does that... consciousness, if you give it a tick, it'll present tick world. Give it a human being, it'll present human world. Consciousness doesn't evolve, right? Brains evolve. Do you see it? What he's saying there is just false. In a sort of in a trivial way, almost. Do you see, this is what's so worrying, because it almost seems unbelievable. I know Maria thinks it's unbelievable that this is our world. These are our experts. Yeah, these are the people who've got PhDs, who are extremely intelligent. Whose very life has been given to studying this, and they're talking a sort of a nonsense. And we, these are our experts. You know, we're on the Titanic. Yes, these are the people on the bridge steering the ship. Only they're not steering the ship, remember? It's hard to describe, but it took me a long time to fully accept that. That really, our most intelligent people, because it takes a certain kind of intelligence and dedication and effort to rise to a position like Thomas Metzinger has. You couldn't write the papers he writes, right? He's got a great intellect. He's a very intelligent person in these worldly standards. And yet, it can't be that he's maybe it's me. You know, that's really what you end up saying. Maybe it's me. Surely, maybe I've misunderstood him. Do you know, he can't be saying something so obviously false. But over the years, I've come to see, yes, you know, actually, generally, I find that people who haven't studied philosophy usually have a better grasp on reality than people who have. That's a terrible thing to say, isn't it? People who haven't studied philosophy, who just, because in actual fact, our immediate understanding of being that just is given to us through our being alive is pretty much correct. I mean, that's in a way, that shouldn't be big news, should it?
Have you ever managed to find them personally?
No, but I've tried arguing with Dave Chalmers.
But in a personal context rather than a public one.
No, I know Dave Chalmers a little bit, and I've met lesser philosophers and attempted to argue the toss with them. Often, if I really get into what I want to say, instead of engaging with me, they start laughing. It's an interesting reaction, because I guess in a way what I'm proposing is so simple and so obvious, it can't be true. So it's not something that a trained philosopher could actually engage with and argue with. It's not as if I'm presenting a highly sophisticated alternative to what they're proposing. I'm just saying, basically, it's nonsense. Do you see, somebody can't engage with you on that level. And I attempted to engage on another level, other levels, you know, presenting papers and things. But in a way, it's almost like you have to sell your soul to do that.
Is that why you're not steering the ship?
Well, I'm steering a little ship here, aren't I? You have to have voluntary crew. Do you know, you can't get up there and say, "All right, everyone, do as I tell you." That ain't going to work. The only thing that will work now is, in some sense, to destroy this picture. Once you've destroyed the picture, well, it's up to you, isn't it?
I mean, the other thing that I would say would be in your favour is I don't think people are holding the universities as the superstructures that they used to. As in, I think that if you could promote excellence in other ways that was like actually achieving better than the now sort of actually not doing brilliant, you get masses of people coming out of university and they aren't excellence. Like, and so there's an argument, well, maybe there isn't some culture of excellence at university and it's not quite being that thing that we thought would make everyone to super, super people. So it's like, if you can do that yourself, or anyone can do that in any way, you will actually supersede the university structures.
Well, what's fun?
University.
What's fun?
Well done. I've always thought, great job, I'm sorry I'm turned up.
I take FUB as a kind of, for me, I thought, it's an anti-university in a way. It's a place where, I can speak the truth as best I understand it.
You can establish a cult.
No.
You have to outperform the university, so that's how you actually then start to win.
But it's not, the universities now are so embedded in our culture, and they're at their decadent phase.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that I watched the decadence occurring when I was there. So it's a bit like the church.
Yeah.
It's like the final stages of the church. I think we may find something like that, that one day that the entire culture is going to wake up and start saying, well, what are these boys doing?
The trick is to outperform all these people.
But I know we're digressing, but I'm concerned. I wouldn't like to see the university system collapse.
No.
And science to fall apart in the way things are at the moment. Because they do represent at least an attempt to stick to the facts, and they actually are holding back something else that is just that isn't even in touch with the facts. It wouldn't be my wish to destroy the university system. Are there going to be a few individuals who start to become attuned to something new, and there are right. There are all over the world. There is a kind of a response to the crisis that we're in, but it has to be an intelligent one now. Mm-hmm. A mass movement ain't going to copy it.
I've never said mass movement. When I say outperform, I mean you provide better quality material that's more digestible. You know, and you provide it in a structure that doesn't bankrupt people in a way that people want to turn off. You know, it's like, that's not taking them down, it's outperforming. It's like, yeah, you know, that's not getting rid of science.
Now, just let me get back to what makes us human. What makes us human is our ability to reflect scientifically. No surprises there. Yes? The brain machine. Yes, it's the usual. It's the Eagleman line. Do you remember the Eagleman line? Really, there's no colour out there at all. You know, I want to say just something about that, about what colour is, because there's this. Because when you study the photons, they're not coloured, right? So and he's saying again, this is another way of just looking at perception. I think we'll stop with this. But colour's very important to me. I looked at it. Well, we're all looking at it, aren't we? So you don't look at colour, that's a kind of...
So what is it?
Now, you see, in order to experience a world, yes, first up, how are you going to experience anything? How are you going to experience the electromagnetic radiation? Or whatever. In order to experience anything, it has to show itself. Yes? That's what consciousness is. There are beings, your beings. You, in some way or other, you have to show yourselves to me in order for me to know you. Yes? In order for me to experience you. And Metzinger and Eagleman and everyone else seems to think that if you were to show yourselves properly to me, you wouldn't have any colour. Now, I just want you to see that this is mad. Because what colour is, as best as I can understand it, is it's a kind of a language. It's a language that expresses or shows the form of the things around you. Yeah, you see the way that the light is on the side of your head, the way it changes, it expresses that your head turns there. You've got a flat forehead there, and then the light catches you and it turns there. And then the darkness of your eyebrows expresses there's a different texture there. Or even scientifically, the light expresses that this surface is different to this surface.
Presents.
Yeah, it presents how the things are. If you took colour away, right, and including black and white, well, you wanted to show form in space, you'd have to invent it all over again. You'd have to invent something like it, wouldn't you?
But then there's all the shades.
All the shades? Well, that's what I was meaning about the shading shows the shape. It's shape. It's called shape from shading. So do you see that language like words, it's quite an abstract form of language, but the sensory qualities are actually the absolute origin of language. The colour is a language of form. It expresses form. No colour, no form. And do you see how stupid it is to say the evening sky is colourless? Well, the colour is, it's again, the colour expresses the meaning.
Yeah. It's the detail that would not be knowable without it.
Yes. The colour is expressing the form of the epsilon. It is just colour. The colour is a language of form. Just like the and to say that the epsilon's colourless is stupid, because our intelligence already knows that we don't see white, do we? We see the surface of the epsilon, and the colour tells us it's an absolutely fundamental expression of the meaning. The meaning is, here is a surface. It's smooth and a bit shiny. The colour tells you that. Do you see how there's a basic misunderstanding in Metzinger that thinks that what we see is colour painted on a wall in the ego tunnel. But what we do is we create a world full of meaning, and the meaning of the perceptual world is expressed in colour. And to say that the evening sky is colourless is just to say that you don't understand perception. You don't understand what it is. You haven't actually looked at it. If I feel like saying, I wish I could be on a podium. You haven't done your phenomenology. And it's not as if you could say, oh, phenomenology, what's that? I mean, it's 120 years old. Everybody's heard of Husserl and Heidegger, you know, Merleau-Ponty, Gadamer, Michel-Henri. To study consciousness and just say, don't need to bother with those, they're all European. They didn't speak English. I'm going tut 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 for the recording. Well, I think that'll have to do, won't it?
Thank you.